Father, I thank you for loving us all, and buying us out of slavery and sin and fear. I ask you to show every person here your blessing, the great love that you have for them, the power that you have to give victory and cause that we have for hope and joy. And I ask, Lord, that you would cause us to be grateful. Help us to be grateful. Remind us to praise you and thank you, and to bring our lives before you. And I pray that you would give us the compassion of Yeshua for the lost. And I ask you to give me grace now, and use me the way that you would like to. In Yeshua's name. I was just thinking about those two guys. They were disciples of Yeshua. I think it was their mother that came to him, and she said something like, Lord, grant that my two sons who sit on your right hand and on your left hand in the kingdom. I can't remember the exact word she used. And y'all familiar with that? And you remember what his answer was? I think he said, yeah, you don't know what you're asking. And then he asked them, didn't he? Are you able to drink the cup that I'm to drink? And what was the answer to that? We lose some people? Well, you don't have to leave. What was the answer to that? Dean, what was the answer?
Yeah.
They said, yes, they were able? How many of you think they knew what it was they were saying? You ever had a moment of enthusiasm? You ever watch a movie and feel like you can do everything the hero or the heroine did, at least while you're watching? Well, some of us don't have those experiences. I think a lot of people get filled with the, you know, what's the word? I don't know.
Vicarious
zeal. Ethos came to my mind. I don't know if that's the right word. Vicarious zeal, probably. But there's a sense in which, you know, you're enthused and you're inspired by the story. It might even be a true story. And the feelings that go with it, and the feelings that go along with the victory, it's like they're inside of you, and you feel like you can, now you can do it. And sometimes people even decide that the next day they're going to, whatever that is. Usually when you wake up in the morning, you don't feel the same as when you were watching the movie. And the mountain seems bigger than it did while you were watching the movie. And you seem smaller than you did while you were watching the movie. And then some other human agency does something that really ticks you off or something. Then you feel even less able to climb the mountain, and it just all kind of crumbles away. I'm not sure, maybe it's better to never feel that way. I was told about one person after they had watched a certain movie that they testified that they never wanted to be the same again. That was actually offered to me as evidence of the godly fruit of that movie. But who thinks that a feeling that you never want to be the same again is evidence of fruit? I mean, if you're like me, you've felt like you never wanted to be the same again probably thousands of times by the time you were 13. And maybe the reason you felt that way so many times is because you discovered just as many times that you're not so different in the way that you were thinking about. So anyway, it's an interesting answer, though, that they got, because which two disciples were they? They were brothers. How many sets of brothers were there among the 12 disciples? Well, somebody has to give me the answer, or I can't continue.
James and John.
I believe so. So, did you hear all that from where you were, Jacob? So, he asked if they could drink the cup he was to drink. I think they also got the answer. They wanted the two best seats. They weren't so bold as to think they could have his seat. That's good. They wanted to sit on the right and the left. Their mother particularly wanted that, I guess. But then the disciples used to argue about which one of them was the greatest. Right? Can you imagine being among a group of your friends arguing about that you're the greatest, and they're arguing, no, I'm the greatest, and everybody's giving their reasons why they're greater than everybody else? I've been in a lot of situations where, to me, it looked like that was going on, even though nobody was actually saying, I am the greatest. They're all acting like they were, and sometimes there's a lot of anger and bitterness and strife, and sometimes grudges, and sometimes everybody's mad at everybody else. And then, you know, God's merciful, so no lightning bolts come down and kill anybody, and then if people live a little longer, they get over it, and they make up, and they realize that God put them in a tumbler together. You know what a rock tumbler does? It goes around and around at a very particular speed. Parts tumblers do the same thing in manufacturing companies. They turn just fast enough so that sometimes they have a little thing that carries things up a little bit, like a clothes dryer. They turn just fast enough so that the parts or the stones get to a certain point, and then they fall. And they keep falling on each other, grinding up against each other, over and over and over and over. And you know what happens to rough edges inside of a tumbler?
You get knocked off, smooth them over.
Yeah, they get worn down. And it's an amazing thing. If a good die maker will make a die so that when you stamp a part, and that a stamping die works like a paper punch, it could be any shape, but it's the same principle. A good die maker will make it so that there's not much of a burr on the part when it drops out of the die. A lousy die maker will have, like, really terrible burrs. But there's usually a little bit of burr, no matter what. They take thousands of these parts, wherever they are, and you throw them in a tumbler. Yes?
What's a burr?
A burr. That is a very good question. I have discovered in my life that when I'm saying things and people don't know what the words I am saying mean, that sometimes they don't know what I mean. And I've met a lot of people who use words I don't know, and sometimes I don't know what they mean. And I've met some people who use words I don't know because they want to sound smart, and they want me to know that I'm dumber than them. And I want to tell you the Hebrew word for those people, because actually the scriptures don't even use that word. Anyway, a burr is a rough spot. So, like, if this was a piece of metal and it had been cut here, and you run your hand, like, you feel it here, and you feel a little rough, something sticking out along the edge, that's a burr. And frequently a burr, and I look for them on manufactured products, and I'm appalled at how many products go to market with dangerous burrs still on them. If you slide your finger along that, it'll cut your finger right open oftentimes. And needless to say, you don't want burrs not on anything. So a burr can be caused on the edge of something by cutting it with a hand snipper, by punching it with a stamping die, or shearing. There are a number of ways burrs come about. So what happens in the tumbler, you throw them in the tumbler. I was once a toolmaker in a manufacturing company. We made a lot of stamped parts. We would put the parts in a big tumbler and go around and around, and they grind against each other. Now, in case you don't know, what I'm describing is corporate life in the body of Messiah. The Lord takes a bunch of people. He dumps them gently, very gently, into the tumbler. Closes the door on the tumbler, and he turns it on, and it starts going. And they go, "This is not what I thought I was getting when I came to faith. Let me out." And the Lord says, "Not for a while." He says, "You'll be okay." And you say, "No, I won't. This is going to kill me." And he says, "No, it's not going to kill you. It's going to make you better." And you say, "No, it's not. It's going to kill me. I'm going to kill some of these people in here. You know, let me out." And he says, "Well, you might, but you know, even murder can be forgiven. And you might not have thought that some of them might kill you." At which point you go, "Oh, didn't think of everything." So it goes round and around. And what happens is the rough edges on the parts get worn off, ground off, bumped off, abraded off, rubbed off. I don't know, I probably come up with a whole bunch of words. And after a while, when you go back to that tumbler, you open it up. If you think about it, those parts will all look like they have scratches all over them. The burrs are all gone. The edges are nice and smooth. You could run your finger down any one of them and you won't get cut. And the funny thing about the scratches is it doesn't so much look like scratches as this nice, even, uniform sort of finish. Because, by the way, even a high polish is really just
fine scratches.
Yes. The art of polishing is a matter of using grit, which makes scratches, and then you go to finer grit, which makes finer scratches. And at a certain point, the scratches are small enough that you can't see them with the naked eye, and the light hits it, and it gleams, and it looks like it's an absolutely perfect surface. But it is, in fact, a series of very, very, very small scratches. And the tumbler does that, except it doesn't polish it quite like that. But it'll come, the thing will come out shiny, it'll look pretty nice, it'll be smooth, and they have an even, uniform surface, which, generally speaking, to me, always looks pretty nice. And I would venture that if each one of those pieces that went into the tumbler had a will and nerve endings and a thought process, that they probably wouldn't like going in there. But they all come out better. Much, much better. So by the way, you all know exactly what you're getting into when you came to faith in Yeshua, right? So they ask this question. Her mother is told she doesn't know what she's asking. So, well, you know, as for those places you mentioned, that's that's up to somebody else. That's, I'm not even going to discuss that with you, but that's for who it's reserved for. But yes, can you drink this cup? And when I think of that passage, I think of how the guy that I'm named after in particular said that he would go to the death with Yeshua and would never leave him, and that he would fight valiantly, and that he must have just watched a movie and gotten filled with enthusiasm and felt like he could do anything, you know, like he felt like he could fly like Tony Stark and all of that stuff, you know. And yeah, now we don't only have Superman that can fly. We've got all kinds of flying superheroes now.
Elon Musk.
So, what?
Elon Musk.
Don't get me going. I don't know that much about him, but I heard a few more things the other day. But there are some impressive things about him, and apparently some really not impressive things. But usually geniuses with money have some really unimpressive things to their name.
They didn't spend long enough in the tumbling.
Yeah.
Maybe not. But he hasn't come out yet. So, so where was I? Yeah, so, you know, Peter claiming he would go to death and all that, filled with enthusiasm. And that was enthusiasm, by the way. That was human enthusiasm. Which, I don't know, maybe, do you know that human enthusiasm is not the evidence of the Holy Spirit at all? Did you know that human enthusiasm frequently causes somebody that believes in Yeshua to feel like they should run out and do certain great conquests? And that they have God's mandate to do it because they're so enthused? You know that? Because even, I wasn't really so much talking at the time, but I was going to say I was involved in an argument about that subject one time. I think I made a couple of comments, but the main part was between two other parties. But it was actually argued that human enthusiasm was this great thing, and then it was put into context by another person. But the thing is, my feeling that I can pull something off, I would say that's enthusiasm. But God's will that I pull it off is very different from my enthusiasm. In fact, I don't think it's even connected. One could be enthused about what God has asked them to do and empowered them to do by His Spirit, but you can be enthused without that, without it being God's will, or with Him without it being His Spirit. And that is, I think that's what some people call the flesh, acting in the flesh. So, in fact, the scriptures, I think, call it that. So, but in this case, it's very interesting. They're asked, can you drink the cup that I am to drink? And they say, yes. And it seems that maybe their yes wasn't a totally idiotic answer. He says something like, yes, and you will. But they had no idea. Had no idea what that meant. But they did drink it, and they were going to drink it. And they said they could. And it's an interesting answer, because at the moment when they said they could, I don't think they were able in any way to drink that cup. But yet, in some prophetic way mixed with stupidity, I don't know if I should go that far, they were telling the truth without knowing anything about the truth they were talking about. I think they're just thinking about the kingdom and the glory, not, you know, like dying on a cross, or, do we know how those two died? I mean, this tradition has, you know, holds that they died in this way or that way. But, they all had some really hard things to go through. Now, I don't know about you, but on the road to glory, I tell you what I would prefer. I would prefer glory. With humility, of course, to be very humble, according to my definition of being humble and humility. Glory, I, you know, I'd things would go well. I'd be able to see obvious evidence that things were working out the way they were supposed to in my life and the things I've got responsibility for. I suppose a few people would admire me. They would honor me. Certainly no one would ever slander me or speak ill of me, and nobody would ever be angry with me because, you know, I don't like it when people are angry with me. I feel responsible. I feel like I have to do something. And usually what I think of doing is the wrong thing to do, and I'd rather not go through that because I'd rather only be in situations where what I'm thinking is the right thing to do. And when people are mad at me, I have all kinds of thoughts that aren't the right thoughts, and I have to figure out or let God tell me which ones are right and which ones are wrong, and then I'm supposed to do stuff too, not just think. So I guess I'd prefer that the cup I drink is a sweet one, not too sweet, not simply sweet, but just right. Just the right temperature. Not have any taste that my tongue says yuck about. And I'd like to know beforehand that everything was going to work out fine all the time. I mean, I suppose I could go on. How would you like things to be? How would you prefer? I'm still looking for the verse that says, I have called you to live out your life according to your preference, under my blessing, with everything you could ever dream of supplied to you just the way you want. But I don't know. It's the book itself, in terms of the printed pages, is finite, and I sure didn't know how finite by now if it's in there, especially with all the fast technological searching tools we have now. It does not seem to be there. So anyway, he says they are going to drink it. And they did drink it. And by the time they drank it, they were very, 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 very different than on the day when they said, yes, we're able. And I don't think they had any idea what they were really talking about, just as their mother in some way had to have really missed who and what she was talking about to actually come and request that her son be given those two seats of honor. So, well, I suppose I should try and start on the message now. Many of you want to develop into all God intended you to be in this life. How many? How many of you can drink the cup that you should drink? Well, he told those two that they would drink it. Does anybody want to drink a cup of beer?
I'm not sure they do.
Maybe I need to frame it differently. The scriptures say daily to take up your cross, right? Who wants to do that? Well, they don't say daily take up your cross, not wanting to. Right? I'm not being critical. I don't really want to take it up either. By the way, it doesn't mean take up a cross and go to Golgotha and get nailed onto it. That's not what it means. Although some people would probably gladly choose that. I think there are probably such people. it would seem very heroic. I mean, it would be really painful, but then they'd be dead, and you know, they wouldn't have to spend 60 years doing something that they really might not want to do. I doubt if any of us actually want to be crucified. I actually suspect that most of Western culture doesn't really understand crucifixion well enough to know just how absolutely horrible it is. And a lot of people, I think, don't think it even happens anymore, and they're wrong about that, too. But taking up your cross and following Yeshua, should that sound like a horrible thing to have to do or need to do? I mean, when you hear that, what do you hear? Take up your cross and live a life of suffering and drudgery where you just can't wait for the sun to set every evening and you just can't wait for the sun to rise all night. I mean, is that what it is? Take up your cross and follow me. Is it a negative? I think sometimes people are carrying a cross, but it's not their cross. And they think that that's the cross they're supposed to be carrying as they follow Yeshua. Does anybody agree with me? It's like there are people like, well, my cross is just to be a martyr every moment of every day. Just, you know, I get the short end of every stick. I wanted the last slice of beef and somebody else took it and ate it. In fact, I waited long enough to make sure that it would be gone so that I could complain and groan about it because I'm a martyr and that's just my calling. I don't expect anything to ever work out for me. That's just what God's given me, and I'm so filled with joy. To not get that piece of meat and to not get the blueberry pie that I looked forward to all week that Joanne or somebody, Johnson, not you, I'm thinking of Minnesota, bakes, you know, where when the crust doesn't turn out, it's still the best crust in the world. It had to have come from glory, and I wait for it, and somebody else gets it, and I'm so happy to be such a martyr that I can spend all my time noticing that I didn't get that piece of pie, and somebody else did, because it's just my calling. I'm good at it. I've learned the secret of discontent. I have learned how to have nothing, even when I could have had everything, and God would have gladly handed it to me, because I'm a martyr, and that's just my calling in life. You know, and there are people like that. And you know what? I don't even mean to cast aspersions on them, because I have to say that when I really look at anybody and their bitter discontent, if I'm really just looking at a human being, I see myself. It may be really extreme. What they're doing may not be at all what I would do in that situation. But there's something in it. It's like, yeah, I'm a human being. And I see that I could laugh at them, but then maybe I shouldn't. Because I look like that over here, or I look like that at this time. And so, thing is about the cross, I don't know, what are we supposed to think about taking up our cross? Is it a negative to take up our cross and follow Yeshua? Is it?
No.
Is it a negative to take hold of the plow? Y'all familiar with that one? It says he who takes hold of the plow and looks back isn't worthy of me. Those verses are really scary, aren't they? Like, I mean, what if you took a look back? salt that you're plowing and you look back. What does it mean? Is putting your hand to the plow the same as taking up your cross in some way, do you think? So if you put your hand to the plow, you're engaging in doing something you're called to do, right? Has God called us to misery and drudgery and things that we hate? Is that what he called us to?
No.
You might
feel that way.
Well, I'm drawing a parallel rather than looking for the differences at the moment, but I agree with you. Well, okay, let's take another look at crosses. When you look at Calvary, you look at that cross on Golgotha, the middle one. What do you see? Something that you don't want?
Something you don't want very much.
See, when you look at that place, what is it? It's life. It's peace. It's purpose. It's a clean heart and conscience. It's a new life. At the horrible, horrible, horrible expense of someone else who didn't deserve what they got at all. The way I understand the scriptures are all the riches of our Father's house belong to us if we are his children. And how did they come to me? They came to me through a cross. A death of an innocent, far more than just innocent, but then there was nobody else like that. All of that comes to me through a cross. So is a cross a negative? It's a horrible thing.
Now what is God's will?
It was God's will. So, Yeshua endured the cross for the joy set before him. By the way, for that joy of you. Realize that? I know, I've met quite a few believers I don't think you couldn't get them to say that I'm for the joy that was set before him. They need to be able to say it. I've met people that think redemption isn't, that they're not so special being redeemed because redemption was worked for so many that this just doesn't make them feel special. What do you think of that? To people like that, I say, you know, when God redeemed you, right then, it was just you that he was redeeming. He's like, he doesn't have so much on his mind that he can't focus on you. There aren't so many that you just disappear and he doesn't even know you're there. It's an interesting subject. The thing is, I know that many, 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 many people were redeemed besides me. But when I came to faith, well, I don't even know if I don't even know if I cared about them. I wasn't thinking about them. I was alone with the Lord. He came to me and showed himself to me, revealed himself to me, and he revealed myself to me And I just, it almost seemed at the moment that the whole world was just the Lord and I coming to an understanding. It seemed very, very personal, very particular, very, very special. I didn't imagine that, oh, well, I just like this for a few million other people, and that's not so special. It's easy to not feel special, but I don't think it ever results from contact with the Lord. It results from other things, but I don't think it ever results from contact with Him. Even when He upbraids you, what does that mean, upbraid? Well, it just has to do with what position you're in when you're braiding. In case we were, never mind. It's when He tells you some things about yourself that you didn't really necessarily want to hear. Or rather, He was happy with everything. He lets you know about some things that are wrong. And I lost my train of thought when He does that.
Still think you're special.
Well, you should think you're special if He does that. Because He wants to take away the thing about you that's hurting you and make it into something that isn't hurting you anymore. That's also better for the purpose you're designed for. So, I have Living on Borrowed Time written across the top of this page here in my notebook, and what kind of time are you living on? We had a very lively discussion this morning about an Israelite father selling his daughter. Oh! I gotta admit, I don't like the thought of selling daughters. I don't like it. But then I never read those passages thinking it was God's idea. He thought, yeah, you know, men should sell their daughters. But that isn't what it's about. But for some reason, the man sells his daughter, and the man that's buying her might be buying her for a wife for himself or for his son. And we were figuring that, well, probably has something to do with an economic circumstance where the seller doesn't have a lot of money, which would mean the daughter probably doesn't have a lot of money either. I don't know all the ins and outs of the passage, but at any rate, she's bought, right? And in the Torah as well, it talks about people selling themselves as slaves. You're familiar with it. So why would someone sell himself as a slave? To eat? A slave to eat? Because they need to eat. So they sell themselves because, they don't have anything else to sell. In fact, that's what the people in Egypt did with Joseph. They said, well, you own the land, you own the animals, you've got our carts, and now you've got our egg baskets. I mean, all we got left is our flesh. I guess we'll sell ourselves to you so that we can eat. It seems ruthless, really, when you look at the whole picture. It just seems way too shrewd in business terms. But we better not get into that. So, an indentured slave is working. They're working off a debt, right? Working off a debt isn't a bad thing to do, right? Ever think about your coming to faith in Yeshua about, you know, it says in Corinthians, it says in 1 Corinthians 6:20, it says, you were bought with a price. And then it says a very un-American thing right after that, you are not your own. Un-American from the beginning to the end. Every letter, every sound, every part of that thought is un-American. You are not your own. Them's fighting words. Don't tread on me. Right? Because the American way is the right way. The American way is that I can do it myself. The American way is that I have a right to everything that I want a right to. Well, actually, that's not necessarily true, at least not if you look at what the Founding Fathers had to say. But some of what they had to say wasn't as pleasing as what people think, because they just remember what they think it all says, not what it actually says or what those guys actually thought or said. I mean, after all, they thought only landowners should be able to vote. And it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness now, because the happiness is meaningless. I mean, if you understand what I'm saying. It was originally life, liberty, and the pursuit of land. You gotta take the land away because, well, there may be too many rich people with too much land for a lot of people to ever end up with any land, so now they can just try to pursue happiness. Which a lot of times seems to be connected to having some land in simple terms of happiness, but at any rate, you were bought with a price, you are not your own. Actually, being bought doesn't sound like a very American thing, although we used to buy people and sell people. And even people who were mixed race to the point where they were more European than African were sold as slaves. I just learned a few little details about that the other day. You suppose Thomas Jefferson bought that girl for himself? For a wife? What do you think?
No.
He apparently bore him 6 kids.
No,
he apparently had a room adjoining his room. If I got the idea right, you could enter her room from his room. We don't know how it started. There were no windows in her room, by the way. But she did have better conditions than most slaves. And I think she may have looked more European than African. Very interesting. I get the impression he actually loved her, from what I'm able to get any access to, but I don't know. Anyway, back to what I was saying. Do you think of yourself as having been bought? Who thinks of themselves as having been purchased? And what were you purchased by? The blood of Yeshua. And if you were going to choose what's behind the other door, what would you pay the bill with? You had a debt. We all had a debt, right? Is there another way to pay it? So you're destitute, right? You can't pay the debt. Somebody else has to pay it. So you get bought. Do you ever think of yourself as, okay, well, I was bought. Did I sell myself? Did I sell myself? I mean, when the Lord met you, did he say, I'm going to buy you and you have to let me buy you? Or did you mentally, spiritually, emotionally accept that you were going to be purchased? Or did he just force you? Did he just send you a letter that says, you're not my property? and you don't have any choice about anything. Which way did it work? You had a choice. So if you took the choice to allow yourself to be bought, are you selling yourself?
You can't sell what you don't own in the first place.
It may not be right to say that we sold ourselves. But what I want to do is just try to draw a parallel between selling yourself as an indentured slave and being purchased by the blood of Yeshua. See, we didn't have to make the transaction, right? So there's a way in which I think we can think of ourselves as, and depending on how you came to faith, you may have even been thinking this, like the prodigal who comes back, right? He's just thinking of himself as a non-family member. He's not a child of his father anymore. He's just going to go back and see if he can just be a slave. In effect, what he's saying is, I'm going to go back and sell myself to my father. And my wages will be I'll get to eat and have a place to stay. This is better than what I've got now that I've squandered everything. Following me? So essentially what he's going to do is spend the rest of his life as an indentured servant, serving his father in exchange for a place to live, for food and what you need to live. So it's possible to come to God not realizing just how great he is. Well, in fact, I think it's not possible to come to God knowing how great he is, even if you think he's great, because we can hardly even begin to understand it. So, if you're bought with a price, you're not your own. And the scriptures talk about, and Paul talks about being a slave of Messiah, right? And he seems to think he owes Messiah everything. He doesn't think he's working off his debt. But there are ways in which he describes himself where what he's describing is as though he's an indentured servant. And in some places he says, I'm speaking in human terms. So the thing is that we owe God everything. We can't keep anything. If we come to Yeshua, we are not our own. We really aren't our own. Which means our will cannot, we can have a will, and we obviously do, but our will isn't really supposed to be our will. Things aren't supposed to be according to our will, unless we allow the Lord to transform us enough that our will is actually His will, and most of the time we're so much in agreement that we don't have this always happening between our will and His will. And that is part of what happens in the tumbler, by the way, is that the will gradually gets transformed so that it agrees with what the Lord's doing. So if you start from the thought that you're a servant, a slave, then in that sense, an indentured slave is working off a debt. I think, by the way, that a lot of believers are acting as though they have to work off their debt, even though it's been paid for. You don't serve God to work off your debt. You don't serve God because you're so pathetic that you now just have to just serve Him. You serve Him because, well, it turns out He's your father, and you're His child. And though some things may have looked like living as an indentured slave, you gradually realize that you misunderstood Him, that He actually loved you, and that everything in His house, his whole wealth is at your disposal, that He doesn't just meter things out, and He's not stingy, but we can think He's stingy. But what's very clear, though, is that when this happens, we have been bought. And if we have been bought, then we are no longer our own. And so that puts some it adds some things to come to an understanding about us for our plans and our will and our sense of rights. And probably what we think of taking up our cross. You think we could take up our cross, whatever it is, for the joy set before us? Did Yeshua complain about the cross? Did he complain about his calling? Is anybody going to say, yeah, but things he was acting according to his own will? Anybody going to say that? He got to choose. Well, maybe he did. Who did he come to serve? Himself? What?
His Father.
He came not to do his own will, but his Father's will, right? He didn't come to serve himself, but the Father, and also to serve other people, right? Even ones that hated him, didn't like him, didn't, you know, slander him, conspired against him. Even prayed for them as they're betraying, lying, convicting, and executing him who didn't deserve any of it. He prayed for them. And he didn't pray, God judged them and see that they give what they got coming, which is the American thing to do, by the way. I love this country. Let me make that clear. I love this country. And as much as is wrong with it and always has been, I think it's a fabulous place to live. I'm afraid it may change more and more until it's less and less and less of all of the good things that it's been. But my faith isn't in this country. And it's not mentioned in the scriptures. And the American way is not one of the biblical virtues, even though a lot of good has come from this country because righteous people have lived in it and still do. God has mercy for the sake of the righteous, not for the sake of America, I'll tell you that. So, who wants people to come to faith? Who wants to show people the love of God? Who wants to show people that slander you and revile you and conspire against you the love of God? I really do. I do want to show that to them. Who feels like it all the time, every day? That was his will, not mine. See, I wanted it to stay up. But I had to yield to truth. So, in this week's Torah portion, it seems like I've been up here for hours. I can't believe it's not 1:30 yet. What? In this week's Torah portion, there's this marvelous verse. Pray for me, by the way, that there's some place we're all supposed to get to. God in his mysterious way has a part for me to play in us, you, me, getting to whatever that is. And why he chose me, I have a hard time figuring out. But he must know what he is doing, even when he looks like he doesn't. So, in this verse, in Exodus 23, says, if you meet your enemy as an ox or as a donkey going astray, you shall bring him back to him. I want to know why it doesn't at least start with, if you find the ox of your best friend, or the person you need a big favor from, going astray, you shall bring it back to him or them. Why doesn't it say that? I guess the scriptures know that we love those that love us, and that we act like we love those we need a favor from. Right? I'm not accusing anyone of insincerity. I'm just, you know, if the shoe fits. Anyway, it says, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring him back to him. Why your enemies? Why does it say that? Who knows that sometimes it's hard to do good for a friend? Who's ever had a friend revile them and in fact express outright rejection, like in a way that sounded like a permanent edict? But who's ever had that happen to them? Does it hurt more when a friend does that than somebody that never was your friend? Could it be harder on some occasions to treat them like a friend than an enemy that's just always been your enemy? Yeah, I think so. So if it can be really hard to stay friends with a friend, and the scriptures ask us to do good to our enemies and treat them like friends, and when we say to the Lord, well, that covers it. I was thinking many more things, but I realized just, then it covers it. Insert whatever it is you're thinking about. The Lord wants us to be like Yeshua. And he knows it's easier to be like Yeshua to somebody that's being like Yeshua to you at the moment. He knows that's easier. But if we want people to come to faith, and we want people to see the love of God, then we have to demonstrate it. They have to be able to discern it in us. And that's shown by how we treat our enemies, and that's shown by how we treat our friends, and that's shown by how we treat our... My hand looks so orange. The manifestation. What's happening? It really did surprise me. I don't know where that color came from. You know what it's all about? Your reactions to your friends. Your reactions to your enemies, your reactions to the neutral people, your reactions to whatever happens. You know what it's all about? It's all about your will. It's all about your sense of justice. It's all about what you naturally feel that you have coming. And you know, I've always noticed about myself is that I usually don't feel like I have coming what I actually have coming. But I have learned over my almost 60 years now to never, ever ask for fairness. Because I know that if I got what was fair, I'd be, well, at least my problems would be over because I'd be dead. I mean, I'd be vaporized if I got what was fair. On my best day, if I got what was fair, I'd get death. I don't want fairness. I'm really glad God's not fair and didn't give me what's fair. In fact, I'm amazed by it. I am so thankful that I have not been treated fairly. But we cry foul and say it's not fair. And in some contexts, yeah, you can use the word kind of, you know, but I hope you know what I mean. He's after our will. He wants to know if we'll let the love of Yeshua come through us then. He knows that when we show love to those that are showing love to us, it doesn't prove anything. That doesn't mean it's not genuine. He's not saying don't love those that love you. He never says that. He doesn't say don't love those that love you. The whole point is that everybody loves those that love them. He came to love everybody that didn't love him, that didn't want him. I mean, it's just not that they just didn't love him, they hated him. They wanted to kill him. They wanted to take his inheritance. He's asking us to love those people. And you know where he teaches us to love those people? In a group of friends, where he teaches us to love each other. That's where we learn a lot about how to love those people. There's nothing like close contact to drive one crazy. We don't have close contact always with the lost. And we can feel such compassion for them, especially when we haven't met them and don't know them. But sometimes when you meet them and start getting to know them, they're not just strangers that you have a dream of fulfilling that feeling from the movie with, or among. It changes. And then we come face to face with Yeshua on the road to fulfilling our own will. And we notice that he looks so starkly different than we do. And once again, we have the chance to sit down at his feet. Just listen and let him teach us. Thinking maybe before you come to God, you're living on borrowed time. In fact, it ought to be God's time, and you're living it out without him. So, stolen, borrowed, pick which one you prefer. But once you've come to the Lord, you're living on purchased time, because you're purchased and you don't belong to yourself, and so time doesn't belong to you. Everything belongs to him. Gives you everything, but you belong to him. It's living on purchased time. So if you're living on purchased time from the standpoint of a slave, Yeshua came to make us his friends, but the examples of servanthood are, well, you do the will of the master, right? And the will of the master is to yield your own will and your own reactions and learn to be like Yeshua, and he keeps giving grace. And so it's a marvelous thing, and we're learning it. And this is an encouraging message I've given Berta. So be encouraged. You're going to get there. He's not going to quit doing what he started. And as far as feelings go, it does feel better a lot of the time when you're agreeing with him than when you're not. Something to think about. Lord, just help us. Help us. Reveal Yeshua more clearly. And let the beauty of your Son more and more be seen in us. And I ask that you show everyone here the beauty of Yeshua that can be seen in them. You haven't failed and you're not failing. We ask you to do your work. And give us